Chapter 14 Miscellaneous Ideas on Management and Organizational Theory. Miscellaneous. There are many important ideas in management and organizational theory that have not been discussed in the previous pages, because of space limitations. Some of these neglected ideas will be briefly discussed in this chapter as follows. The 360-degree appraisal system. The 360-degree appraisal system is a method of obtaining performance-related feedback from a number of sources, such as from superiors, colleagues, subordinates, and customers. This method of evaluation is more useful than obtaining information from one source because people will evaluate performance of an individual from a very different perspective as a result of their role, prejudices, their values, their knowledge, their personal experiences with the individual, etc. The 360-degree appraisal system has some potential application in the personal life of the individual. That is, an individual can obtain a picture of themselves by seeking evaluations from parents, instructors, friends, spouse, girlfriend, boyfriend, etc. In actual practice, you can probably obtain a good estimate of what people think of you, including superiors and subordinates in the work environment, by asking yourself the following questions. What does X think of my performance? How does X feel about me? What areas would X recommend that I improve? These questions will bring to mind the subtle feedback you already obtained as a result of interacting with the people in your personal and work environments. Computer technology. Computer technology developed in a series of stages, which are first-generation computers 1951 to 1958, second-generation computers 1959 to 1963, third-generation computers 1964 to 1970, fourth-generation computers 1971 to 1989, fifth-generation computers 1990 to the present. This developmental sequence had a progressively increasing impact on organizations, and is described in the following paragraphs. Computer technology started with vacuum tube computers, which had drum memories that were slow and limited in storage capability. The impact on organizations started in 1951, when Remington Rand introduced a computer of this type, called the UNIVAC I. There were experimental computers before the introduction of this vacuum tube computer, but the UNIVAC I was the first commercially available computer. The Census Bureau and General Electric purchased the first model of the UNIVAC. International Business Machines introduced a more popular model, IBM 650, in 1955. Similar vacuum tube computers were marketed to business and government until 1958. These first-generation computers were very difficult to use and extremely expensive. They were generally programmed with a primitive programming procedure, called machine code, which made writing programs extremely difficult. However, there were new higher-level programming languages under development in this period, which theoretically could have been used with these early computers. These computers were gigantic, they produced a considerable amount of heat, broke down frequently, because they used vacuum tubes. To remedy the difficulties associated with vacuum tubes, the second-generation computers, which contained many individual transistors, were introduced in 1959 to 1963. These computers were much smaller, less expensive, faster, had a better type of memory, called magnetic core memory, and could be programmed with the newly developed high-level programming languages. These computers were reliable, and produced much less heat because of the use of transistors instead of vacuum tubes. However, most of these computers were still extremely expensive, with prices ranging to over $1 million. The first relatively low-priced computer in this general category was introduced by Digital Equipment Corporation in 1960, and it cost approximately $120,000. Computers of this type were called mini-computers, and their low price made computer purchase desirable for less wealthy and smaller organizations. The third-generation computers were introduced 1964 to 1970, and they used integrated circuits. Each integrated circuit contained many tiny transistors etched onto a silicon chip. This reduced the size and cost of computers significantly. The silicon chip also increased the speed and reduced the heat problem that was present in the earlier computers. In addition to the integrated circuits, these computers had a better memory system, which involved semiconductor memories and magnetic disk storage. These computers were introduced by IBM and other companies. All the IBM models in this category were called System/360. Some of the System/360 models were relatively small and inexpensive, and others were large, powerful, and costly. All the System/360 models were compatible in relation to programming. That is, a program written for one of these IBM models would run on any System/360. This idea of compatibility was followed by other companies, and today we take it for granted that software will run on many different models and brands of computers. The fourth generation involved a number of technological advances that were introduced between 1971 to 1989. The primary advancement of this period was in the development of silicon chips that had a huge number of transistors etched onto a single slab of silicon. It was possible to create an entire microprocessor with a single piece of silicon. This made it possible to create microcomputers, which were first introduced in the mid-70s. These are the personal computers that are reasonable enough for small companies and individuals to buy. The first microcomputer designed for personal use was introduced into the market in kit form, for hobbyists, by Altair, in 1975. The Apple I was introduced shortly after, which was followed by the Apple II in 1977. IBM also started to produce personal computers in 1981. These computers, with appropriate software, were good word processors, and suitable for mathematical calculations. However, these personal computers had limitations, which were the result of inadequacies in hardware and software. One of the major limitations related to the use of random access memory RAM. That is, most of these computers could not handle much RAM, and if you found one that could, you still had a memory problem, which might be less severe. The reason for this is the DOS operating system required to run most software on personal computers had a memory limitation of 640 kilobytes. This problem with memory limitations was eventually solved in the fifth computer generation with the introduction of Windows 95, 98, and Windows NT. This newer software has a memory capability that greatly exceeds the current need for random access memory in personal computers. Note: the following note is somewhat technical, but if the reader has a background in computer technology, it will be understandable. The limitation of the DOS system was the result of its 16-bit configuration, which was designed for the first personal computers on the market. These computers were 16-bit computers and could not handle much random access memory. 16-bit means, in effect, that it has the random access memory capability of 216 equals 65,536 bytes 640 kilobytes. In the actual situation, it was less than this number because some of this memory was allocated for device drivers. When the 32-bit computers were introduced, the old DOS operating system was still 16-bit, which more or less limited the computer to the same 65,536 bytes 640 kilobytes of conventional memory. Software developers tried to create special memory manager programs and extended memory programs that would allow the utilization of more random access memory in the new 32-bit computers. However, this type of software did not work very well. What was needed was a 32-bit operating system to function on the 32-bit computers. Windows 95, 98 and Windows NT were operating systems that solved the problem, because these operating systems are 32-bit. This means that the theoretical amount of memory that can be handled efficiently is 232 equals 4,294,967,296 bytes 4 gigabytes. Actually, about half of this memory capability would be available for applications. However, even the best and most expensive personal computers can only handle, to date, approximately 377,487,360 bytes 360 megabytes of physical memory. Thus, the new operating systems do not restrict the memory capability of the computer. The huge memory handling capacity of Windows 95, 98, and Windows NT allows modern personal computers to run many programs simultaneously, without any difficulties, which is similar to the capability of a mainframe computer. Of course, to do this you must have an adequate amount of physical memory installed in the computer circuitry. End of note. The fifth generation computers represent technological developments from 1990 to the present. These computers have some of the capabilities of human beings, as a result of the advancements in silicon chips, random access memory, video and sound circuitry, and software design. These computers, with appropriate software and hardware, can read text, which is verbalized in a computer-generated synthetic voice, translate human speech into typewritten text, can follow verbal commands to perform computer-related tasks, such as printing a page in response to a verbal request, can translate human handwriting into typewritten text, can type scan information from conventional books directly into the computer, can mimic the reasoning of experts, and can control highly sophisticated machines. In addition, these computers can be used to play or create video, can record and play sound like a stereophonic tape recorder. The computers can also be used as a communication device, with spoken language, graphics, motion video, or written text, through conventional telephone lines, or through direct computer wiring connections. With the fifth generation computers, it is relatively easy to send a fax directly from a word processing program. The computer, if properly programmed, will automatically dial several numbers in succession and transmit the same fax to each number. Fifth generation computers are much less expensive than the earlier computers. It is possible to obtain a personal computer that can perform all of the operations mentioned above for under $1,500. It was possible to obtain a fourth generation mini computer that could perform any of the above functions, but such a computer would cost at least $100,000. The latest fifth generation computers are actually more powerful than the early mini computers and even the early mainframe computers, which were priced in the millions. The personal computers, from the fifth generation, can operate several programs simultaneously, with Windows NT, 95, or 98 and some other software packages. This capability is called multitasking, and it is a capability that was only associated with mainframe computers in the past. As a result of the above developments, computer technology is a part of many jobs in the modern organization. Secretaries, engineers, architects, graphic artists, writers, executives, managers, can spend much of their working hours at the computer. Computers can monitor their work and identify employees that are not performing adequately. As a result of the new technology, many employees can be managed with less managerial personnel. Perhaps the key to success, in modern times, is to learn how to do your job skillfully with a computer. This generally includes writing and communicating with a computer. For example, engineers are expected to have expertise with the use of computer-aided design programs, CAD programs. Secretaries are expected to know how to use word processing programs. Graphic artists are expected to know how to use drawing programs. And managers should know how to communicate, find information, and write with a computer. In the future, managers and other employees might be expected to complete their written work without the assistance of a secretary, even if the employees cannot type. The new software, generally called speech-to-text, can convert spoken words directly into text. The software is produced by Dragon Naturally Speaking Preferred, which cost $180, IBM Via Voice Executive 98 cost about $150, and other companies. The user dictates directly into a microphone connected to the computer, and the words are automatically typed by the computer into a word processing program. The above software, Naturally Speaking Preferred, and Via Voice Executive 98, can even read back the document in a computer-generated voice, to aid in proofreading. This technology can eliminate the need for conventional dictation devices, and it might also reduce the need for secretaries and proofreaders. Management by objective. What is management by objective? The basic concept of this management strategy can be seen in the following definitions. 1. This was a quote MBO, a systematic approach that allows management to focus on achievable goals and to attain the best possible results from available resources. Montana P. and Charnod B. 1993 Management, 2nd ed. Pages 450. 2. An approach that emphasizes the development of objectives, goals for organizational units and individual employees, and the review of performance against those objectives. This was a quote Hal Riegel, D. and Slocum, Jr., J.W. 1996 Management, 7th ed. Pages 181. 3. The system in which managers and subordinates jointly set objectives to use as the basis for operating the business and evaluating performance. This was a quote Luthans F. and Hojets R. 1992 Business 2nd ed. pg 7. 4. A program that encompasses specific goals, participatively set, for an explicit time period, with feedback on goal progress. This was a quote Robbins, S.P. 1996 Organizational Behavior 7th ed. Pages 252. These definitions provide the basic idea of management by objective, but they do not provide enough explanatory detail. Thus, I am defining and explaining the concept in more detail in the following paragraphs. Management by objective is a management methodology that involves cooperatively setting a set of goals that relate to the organizational objectives. The goals are set, with a clearly delineated time limit, for organizational divisions, departments, and employees. This is ideally done in such a way that if the employees achieve their goals, their department will achieve its goals, and if the department achieves its goals, the division will achieve its goals, which will contribute to the organizational objectives. If all the organizational divisions achieve their goals, the organization will achieve its objectives. This involves the following sequence of cooperative goal setting. The goals set for each division relate to the organizational objective. Goals set for a department relate to the goals set by its division. Goals set with employees relate to the goals of their department. Of course, with very small organizations, which do not have any divisions or departments, the employees' goals should relate directly to the organizational objectives. The goals are set cooperatively and jointly by superiors and subordinates. This is done, or should be done, with the understanding that the superior will evaluate the performance and give feedback to the subordinate. The feedback should be provided while the efforts to obtain the goal are in progress. This gives the subordinate an opportunity to correct his behavior or work performance, if it is inadequate. Thus, early and continuous or periodic feedback can help subordinates prevent failure. The goals that are set with management by objective are precise, measurable, and relate to a tangible result. Imprecise goals or goals that cannot be evaluated or measured are avoided, such as do your best. Try to be more careful. Try to work a little faster. Try not to make so many errors. An example of an appropriate goal for management by objective would be for an organization to increase its productivity 10% in 1 year, without additional employees or equipment, as measured by the number of completed items coming off the assembly line. This organizational objective would be broken down into a series of related goals for each division, department, and employee. Each employee might have to increase his productivity by a certain percentage. Employees that were not working very diligently might be encouraged to agree to increase their productivity by significantly more than 10%. Employees that were already highly productive might increase their productivity by a smaller amount, less than 10%, because they are probably already working near their maximum capacity. Note, perhaps a goal of increasing productivity by 10% could be achieved by eliminating or reducing the number of unauthorized breaks and excessively slow work rates, which is a common problem in many organizations. End of note. The goals that are set with management by objective can be placed in three categories, which are routine, innovative, and improvement. Routine goals are objectives that are generally part of the job, and usually must be repeated periodically. Such goals are not unusual or innovative. Innovative goals relate to innovation or creativity, such as the creation of a new product. Improvement goals relate to improving an entity, such as improving your work performance, improving productivity, improving interpersonal communications in the work environment, etc. Routine goals are probably the easiest to achieve, within a predetermined time limit, because there is generally no mystery on how to obtain such goals. If we are not sure how to obtain a routine goal, we can easily obtain the information, such as by asking an experienced person to instruct us. With innovative goals, the situation is very different. We simply may not know how to obtain the goal. Often innovative goals require extensive experimentation and an unpredictable amount of financial resources and time. Thus, innovative goals can be difficult to complete within a predetermined time limit, because there can be many unforeseen difficulties involved. Improvement goals can also be difficult to obtain within a predetermined time limit in some cases. This is especially true if the improvement involves human behavior, such as improving work performance. If the improvement is focused on a non-human entity, such as machinery, an office, a factory, then the situation is more predictable. Such improvement goals can often be completed within a predicted time period. Goals that are set between superior and subordinate can be put in written form, which is called a performance contract. The performance contract states the responsibilities of a subordinate's job and related goals. It can, and should, indicate how the goals and related performance will be evaluated. The performance contract should also indicate the relevant time limits in relation to obtaining the goals. The contract should also indicate rewards for obtaining the goals and the consequences of failure. The performance contract and the stated time limits will probably work well with most routine goals. It will probably also work quite well with improvement goals that involve non-human entities. However, innovative goals and improvement goals that involve human behavior, as stated above, have an unpredictable quality. It can be difficult or impossible to predict the precise time and resource requirements or final results when attempting such goals. This unpredictability should be kept in mind when creating a performance contract. When goals are achieved, rewards should be provided by management or the superior. This can involve praise, money, additional time off, an opportunity for job advancement, etc. Rewards in the form of praise should be provided before the goal is obtained, if the employee is doing very good work that will obviously lead to the attainment of the goal. The basic idea behind management by objective can be applied to the personal life of an individual. That is, setting precise goals that can be measured, with appropriate time limitations, can be an effective way of improving performance and achievements in many areas of life, including academic performance. The disadvantages to management by objective include all of the following. It is not always feasible to set precise goals that can be measured, especially if the goals have time limits. Precise goal setting with time limitations is often not feasible for experimental research, for situations that are unpredictable, for jobs that involve creativity and/or trial and error. Applying measurable goals in some job-related situations can be counterproductive to organizational objectives. For example, if you measure the performance of human resource personnel by the number of interviews they carry out in a week, the result might be many poor or useless interviews quickly performed, in an effort to meet the goal. However, if management by objective is applied to the right situation and used in a proper way, it can be a highly effective method. It delineates precise requirements, the goals, in a cooperative way. Management by objective serves to communicate what is wanted and expected from employees. Its cooperative nature also serves a communication purpose, which can provide management information from employees, in relation to their limitations, capabilities, and their inclination to work at a certain pace or certain way. Manufacturing a product. Before a product is marketed, it must be created. This process is not exactly the same for all products, all industries, and all companies. However, a basic process of manufacturing, which does not apply to all situations, can be represented in 9 steps, as follows. 1. A need is identified in terms of a problem. This can happen as a result of market research or a common sense assessment of human desires. Sometimes, the actual desire for a product is created by advertising after the product is placed on the market. For example, nobody really seemed to need a large screen-colored television set until it was invented and advertised. This is the case with many of the modern electronic devices that are used primarily for entertainment. Certain electronic devices, such as computers, dealt with needs that existed before the device was marketed. For example, the needs to perform calculations, type, edit, and file documents existed before there were computers, but the old methods were less efficient than computer methods. 2. Experimental research and/or preliminary engineering is applied to the problem. This can in some cases involve an assessment to determine if the product could be manufactured and marketed at reasonable cost. 3. The product is designed by one or more engineers. With modern products, this step usually requires a team of engineers. With very complicated products, it can involve a number of engineering teams working on different components of the product. 4. A prototype of the product is built based on the engineering diagrams created in step 3. Then it is tested and evaluated. This might lead to additional work for the engineers, in terms of modifying the prototype. 6. Based on the testing of the prototype, additional engineering designs are created. This can involve the creation of more prototypes in some cases, or the final design of the product. 7. The factory where the product will be produced is set up with appropriate equipment and personnel to make the product. This can be an extremely involved and expensive engineering and management project for complex products that are mass-produced, such as automobiles, refrigerators, or other major appliances. Some products are not mass-produced. They may be created in relatively small quantities, based on the number of orders, such as large airplanes. Production of certain items requires creating only one product, such as large ships, space satellites, skyscrapers. In such cases, the setup is generally less complicated than it would be to mass-produce the same product. However, usually much elaborate equipment and highly skilled personnel are required to build non-mass-produced products. 8. After the production facility is set up, the product is manufactured. The production facility might be carefully monitored, especially in the early days of its operation, to detect deficiencies in its design. If any deficiencies are detected, modifications may be applied to the facility to correct the problem. 9. The product is marketed. In some cases, the marketing of the product begins before the product is created, such as with one-of-a-kind items that are made to order, such as large ships. The basics of the marketing process is discussed in more detail under the next heading. Marketing. Organizations generally produce one or more products or services, which have to be marketed by some means. Marketing any type of product, providing any type service, starts with an understanding of the needs of the consumer. The question that must be answered is, what are the needs, or potential needs, of the consumer? How can the product we are trying to sell satisfy the needs, or potential needs, of the consumer? The way a product is marketed depends on the product and how it is produced. If it is a one-of-a-kind product, which is usually built to order, such as a large ship, the customer is generally obtained before the product is built. In some cases, preliminary engineering diagrams and/or scale models might be created to persuade the potential customer to order the product from a specific company. This can also involve an estimated or actual price to produce the product. This procedure can involve competition, including competitive bidding, from other companies who also have the expertise and facilities to build the product. Products that are sold in relatively small quantities, such as large passenger planes, might be created in very small quantities for testing, demonstration, and marketing purposes. When customer orders are obtained, additional units may be built to fill their orders. The companies that build very expensive non-mass-produced products, such as large ships or airplanes, have very few customers. Thus, it is relatively easy to contact and communicate with these customers by conventional methods, such as personal correspondence, telephone calls, and face-to-face discussions. Organizations that create mass-produced products have a very different type of challenge. They have to contact thousands, millions, or even hundreds of millions of potential customers. The marketing of mass-produced products can be a very involved and expensive procedure. This can be summarized in 5 steps, which are delineated under the 5 numbered headings that follow. 1. A need, or potential need, is identified that is believed to be common to many thousands, hundreds of thousands, or millions of people. Identifying a major need, or potential need, is not adequate for mass production and mass marketing. The need, or potential need, must involve a very large number of potential customers. If the item is relatively expensive, such as luxury automobiles, the number of potential customers can be in the thousands. However, if the item is less expensive, the numbers generally must be in the hundreds of thousands or millions to justify mass production and mass marketing. Note the words potential need was used because the actual need is sometimes created with advertising after the product has been put on the market. 2. In an effort to delineate a reasonable number of consumers that will need the mass-produced product, the potential consumers might be delineated in terms of market segments. This can involve categories such as age, sex, ethnic background, geographic location, income level, level of education. It can also involve more precise characteristics of the potential customers, such as their interests, hobbies, and personal needs, as based on their previous purchases of goods and services. For example, an American manufacturer of instructional mathematics software will be interested in students who own computers in English-speaking parts of the world. Incidentally, this market can be substantially expanded by producing the mathematics programs in different languages and marketing it throughout the world. The manufacturer might also be interested in selling the mathematics software to other market segments, such as engineers and similar professionals who may have forgotten certain aspects of advanced mathematics. Another example is a manufacturer of electric shavers. Such a company would be ultimately selling to adult males who live in the United States, Canada, Europe, and other parts of the world. This is a fairly large market, but it can be substantially expanded if the manufacturer also makes a version of the electric razor for women, such as to shave legs and arms. In general, the questions to consider in the marketing process are: what are the market segments that will be interested in the product? How can the market be expanded? Can the market be expanded by modifying the product or by making a different version of it? 3. Based on the market segments derived in Step 2, the company might engage in market research to determine if the need, or potential need, for the product exists. Such research can also reveal the true needs of the consumer. This research can also involve test marketing of the product in representative geographical areas. 4. The next step is to develop distribution channels for the product. This involves creating a plan that delineates the method of distributing and selling the product. For example, a product can be sold by selling it to a wholesaler, who will sell it to a retailer, who will sell it to the consumer. Another method is to sell the product directly to the consumer by mail order. And still another method is to have salesmen selling the product directly to retailers, who will sell it to the consumer. Of course, there are many other channels of distribution for a product. A primary consideration is how to transport the product through the distribution channels. If the product is not perishable and is not extremely large, it might be shipped by mail, UPS, or a similar company. If the product is very large and bulky, such as large pieces of furniture, the most feasible way of shipping it might be by contracting with a trucking company. If the product is perishable and requires refrigeration, such as ice cream, it might have to be delivered in company-owned refrigeration trucks. 5. The product has to be advertised. The exact type and methods of advertising will depend on the product, the relevant market segments, and the distribution channels. For example, if a manufacturer is selling electric shavers through wholesalers, the company may have to persuade the wholesaler to purchase the product. The manufacturer might also have to persuade the retailer to buy the product from the wholesaler, and the manufacturer will have to persuade the ultimate consumer to buy the product from the retailer. Thus, 3 different advertising methods might have to be used in the above example, one for the wholesaler, one for the retailer, and one for the consumer. Prejudice in relation to organizations and management. The traditional organizational structure tended to unfairly discriminate against women, minority groups, homosexuals, people over 40 years of age, the handicapped, and almost anyone that was a little different from the image believed to be proper by management. However, this traditional structure offered specifically defined jobs for each group. There were jobs for women, such as secretary, receptionist, nurse, elementary school teacher, jobs for minorities, janitor, handyman, security guard, etc. And jobs for white males, executive, manager, salesman, etc. A woman or minority applying for an executive position did not have much of a chance of getting the job no matter how qualified the applicant was. A homosexual had a better chance than a woman or minority if he was white and he totally concealed his sexual orientation. A white male would most likely experience unfair discrimination if he applied for a job that was traditionally filled by a woman, such as a secretary. The discrimination did not start in business organizations, it started in infancy within the family, and it continued as the child developed, within the community and school system. Females were socialized and educated to do jobs that were erroneously believed to be feminine: nurse, beautician, secretary, housekeeper, etc. Males were socialized to take occupations that were considered masculine: law enforcement officer, soldier, lawyer, physician, etc. Minorities had less money, less educational opportunities, and were often socialized into unskilled or semi-skilled occupational roles, such as a janitor. Of course, the prejudicial system was not an absolute. It was a set of norms that influenced behavior of most people, but there were individuals that were not influenced. Thus, there were a relatively small number of people who were performing occupations that contradicted the stereotype, such as women doctors, executives from minority groups, etc. These exceptions should have convinced society that their prejudicial assumptions were incorrect. However, most people interpreted the exceptions as unusual people with special abilities, which allowed society to maintain its prejudicial assumptions. Although the prejudicial system was obviously unfair and highly discriminatory, it was not based on hatred. It was based on ignorance. Hatred would appear when someone tried to violate the norms of the prejudicial system in an open or highly public way. Most people, white and minorities, males and females, believed that there were proper roles for different types of people. This belief was based on erroneous assumptions about the potential abilities of white males, minorities, and women. Males were believed to have greater intellectual and leadership abilities. It was believed that women had superior nurturing abilities, especially with children. Minorities were thought to be less intelligent, but capable of working with their hands, at unskilled, semi-skilled work, or even in a skilled trade in some cases. Handicapped people were believed to be unnecessary burdens that should be avoided. The discriminatory beliefs became a self-fulfilling prophecy. That is, people were socialized and educated according to the erroneous beliefs, which limited their actualized abilities in such a way as to support the prejudicial stereotypes. The above situation started to change in the early 60s, partly as a result of the efforts of Dr. Martin Luther King and his followers. This was followed by many other civil rights movements, for black people, for women, for homosexuals, etc. People throughout the United States became more aware of the discriminatory system that they were living under. The 1964 Federal Civil Rights Act greatly stimulated the changes that were taking place by making it illegal to discriminate based on race, color, religion, national origin, or gender. This law was followed by a number of anti-discrimination laws, including the following: the Age Discrimination in Employment Act of 1967, the Equal Employment Opportunity Act of 1972, the Pregnancy Discrimination Act of 1978, the Civil Rights Act of 1991, the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990. Human Resource Management. What is human resource management? The following definitions provide a basic delineation of the concept. 1. The term generally applied to those activities concerning the management of people. This was a quote Montana P. and Charnod B. 1993 Management, 2nd ed. Pages 449. 2. The philosophies, policies, programs, practices, and decisions that affect the people who work for an organization. This was a quote Hal Riegel, D. and Slocum, Jr., J.W. 1996 Management, 7th ed. Pages 366. I will define and explain the term in more detail in the following paragraphs. Human resource management is a managerial perspective, or philosophy, that focuses on the management of employees, with the assumption that human beings are valuable resources. In the simplest sense, human resource management is the management of employees, as opposed to the management of physical entities, money, or data. In a more complex sense, it is a philosophy, which is elegantly expressed by Montana and Charnod, pages 278-279 as follows. Human resource management beginning in the 1970s, a newer approach to managing employees developed. Today's effective managers regard their employees as important resources, human resources having a great deal of untapped potential. Under human resource management, the manager's job is to create an environment in which employees can unleash their considerable potential and use it for the good of both the organization and themselves. Instead of trying to structure jobs rigidly and monitor employees' behavior closely as under scientific management or trying to make employees feel that they are all part of one big, happy family, early behavioral management, the human resource approach recognizes the importance of people to organizational performance and seeks to provide them with the opportunity to develop their full potential. Today, this takes such forms as employee involvement and empowerment. It is estimated that 50 to 60% of large U.S. corporations now use quality circles, problem-solving groups, and other ways to get employee suggestions. Another 5 to 10% have work teams that allow the workers themselves to make decisions about hiring, firing, and pay. This was a quote. The quotation of Montana and Charnov describes human resource management in terms that can be classified as a theory-y management philosophy, or a humanistic perspective. That is, human resource management, as described in the above paragraph, is humanistic perspective of management. Whether you consider human resource management in the simple sense of managing people, as opposed to managing material entities, machines, energy, data, money, or in the philosophical sense, it involves all of the following. Writing job descriptions. Recruiting and selecting new employees. Interviewing potential employees. Evaluating potential employees. Selecting potential employees. Socializing employees in relation to the organizational culture. Training employees. Motivating employees. Leading employees. Supervising employees. Dealing with the problems of employees. Evaluating employee performance. Rewarding employees for good work. Taking action, and supervising, to prevent or eliminate unfair discrimination. Punishing employees for breaking rules or deliberately working in an inadequate way. Firing unsuitable employees. Scientific management. What is scientific management? The following definitions will provide a basic idea of what this concept means. 1. A traditional management system that focuses on individual worker-machine relationships in manufacturing plants. This was a quote Hal Riegel, D. and Slocum, Jr., J.W. 1996 Management, 7th ed. Pages 45. 2. An approach started around 1900 that used engineering techniques such as time and motion analysis to increase plant efficiency by establishing the one best method for each task. This was a quote Luthans F. and Hojets R. 1992 Business 2nd ed. Pages 276. I will define and explain scientific management in more detail in the following paragraphs. Scientific management is a methodology that consists of the application of scientific evaluation to increase work efficiency. This methodology was originally introduced by Frederick W. Taylor, an engineer, in his book Principles of Scientific Management, in 1911. The method was primarily focused on factory workers, such as laborers loading pig iron, workers shoveling materials of varying weights. Taylor focused on time and motion studies of the workers. This involved analyzing each movement the workers made in their job, with an attempt to eliminate unnecessary and or inefficient movements. Taylor tried to simplify jobs and increase work efficiency. He tried to determine optimum load levels for manual labor, such as the most efficient weight and shovel size for each type of material. The ultimate goal was to find the one best way to perform each of the tasks making up a job. Basically, Taylor's technique can be summarized as one: carefully observe and study the job, in terms of efficiency or time and motion, with the goal of delineating the one best method of doing the job. The idea behind this step is most jobs were performed by workers in an inefficient manner. The workers performed their job based on their own uneducated judgment, which Taylor perceived to be inadequate. Taylor would attempt to find a highly efficient way of doing a job, which he called the one best method. 2. Carefully select each worker for a job in terms of their abilities to perform the required tasks and movements in an efficient and effective way. Workers that have deficiencies or weaknesses that might interfere with the job should be excluded. Such workers might be able to perform the job, but they will be difficult to motivate and they will produce a lower than desired output. 3. Train each worker in the one best method to perform their job. The one best method was determined by scientific study of the job, in terms of precise movements and procedures, which the workers were required to learn. 4. Maintain a cooperative atmosphere, including higher wages, to encourage workers to perform the job, according to the methods and rules that relate to the one best method of doing the job. This includes making the association between productivity of the workers and increased financial reward for their efforts. 5. Management and the employees are to take appropriate responsibility and apply appropriate efforts for the portion of the work that they do best. That is, the job and responsibilities of management, as Taylor perceived it, were to train the employees precisely how to do their job in terms of the one best method, and closely supervise them to be certain that they did their job according to the one best method. The responsibilities of the workers were to learn their job, and do it, according to the one best method, and to follow the rules and orders of management. In situations where Taylor's method of scientific management was applied, there was usually a great increase in work efficiency, which often resulted in more than 200% increase in work output. Thus, Taylor's basic premises were correct, at least for the uneducated manual laborers he was supervising. Taylor's scientific management tended to result in a Theory X management style. Perhaps this was functional for the situation that existed with unskilled laborers in the late 1800s and early 1900s. However, workers often do not like a Theory X management style. They do not like to be constantly supervised. They do not like to have someone tell them precisely how to do their jobs, which can convey the message to the worker that he is a machine without any intelligence or creativity. They do not like someone else to pace their work, which can limit rest breaks. They do not like to work to the near maximum levels often required by Taylor's scientific management. They want more than financial rewards for their work. Taylor's style of management would offer a moderate increase in salary, such as from a $1.15 per day to a $1.85 a day for increasing the work output by 2 or 3 times. Workers often want mental stimulation, prestige, a feeling of accomplishment, and many other intrinsic rewards from their work. Taylor's scientific management only offered boredom, fatigue, and a modest increase in wages. Taylor's scientific management and similar techniques are elegantly criticized in Industrial Organizational Psychology by Saul and Knight, as follows. There is little question that jobs designed on the basis of scientific management and bureaucratic principles are more efficient in terms of the time spent to perform specific tasks, and that these approaches resulted in economic savings for the companies that used them. However, these savings were typically short-lived because simplification and standardization have negative long-term side effects such as monotony and boredom that can in turn have a negative impact on workers' attitudes. Dunham, 1979. As we saw in Chapter 9, negative attitudes toward work and low job satisfaction may be related to withdrawal behaviors such as absenteeism and turnover, which are usually costly for companies. This was a quote. The problem with scientific management, especially Taylor's early delineation of scientific management, is it is primarily focused on physics in terms of the physical movements involved with work. It neglects the psychological, sociological, and physiological components of work. That is, the many components that are involved with work fall into 4 categories, which are physics, physiology, psychology, and sociology. Taylor focused most of his efforts on physics at the expense of the other components. This suggests some insight and a solution. Specifically, scientific management can, and should, be based on physics, physiology, psychology, and sociology. This means it is necessary to use a multidisciplinary scientific approach to the study of jobs and employees, which include all 4 factor categories mentioned above. I will call this multidisciplinary scientific management to distinguish it from Taylor's style of management. This concept is briefly discussed in the following paragraphs, which contains a numbered heading for each of the disciplines. 1. The physics involved with the work. Taylor considered and applied this component well. The physics involves the movements and expenditure of time and energy. This should be reduced to a minimum, providing it does not interfere with the physiological, psychological and sociological components. A modern technique that is sometimes used to study the physics of work and increase work efficiency is motion video or motion picture film. This technique allows the studying of each movement associated with a task by slowing up the film to study each movement. Physics is relevant to both physical and mental work. This becomes apparent if you study a person working at a computer. Improper hand movements working the keyboard can waste time and cause injury to the arm. Improper posture can also waste time and cause injury. Anybody working at a desk or workshop bench can waste time, movements, and energy if the work area is not properly configured. All the documents, tools, materials, personnel should be available at the worksite without excessive or distracting movements. Note, as you read through this text, it will become apparent that physical components overlap and impact on the physiological components, and the physiological components overlap and impact on the psychological components, and the psychological components can overlap and impact on the sociological components, and vice versa. Actually, all the components overlap and impact on each other to some degree, because human beings and their relationship with the work they are doing comprise a system. The general tendency is any single component of a system will affect all other components of the system to some degree. For example, if a worker has a poor work posture as a result of an inadequate chair and worksite configuration, his physical efficiency will be reduced. However, the posture problem might cause a backache, a physiological problem, which can result in adverse psychological responses as a result of pain. This can cause social problems, in some cases, if the worker becomes hostile or complains in a way that is inappropriate. To the physiological components associated with the work, all types of work, physical or mental, produce some physiological effects on the body. Some of these effects can be stimulating and healthy, and some can cause fatigue or even illness and interfere with work performance. Mild physical exercise, with appropriate rest periods, is generally healthy for most people. Thus, work that results in such exercise, with periodic rest breaks, will probably increase the health of the employee as he performs his job. Work that involves little or no exercise, or work that requires exercise beyond the capability of the employee, will probably have a detrimental effect on health, which will probably interfere with work efficiency in the long run. Office work is probably quite unhealthy in most situations, because it limits and discourages physical exercise during working hours. If the employee gets a relatively large amount of exercise when he is not at work, the detrimental effect will be reduced or eliminated. A very important physiological component, which overlaps psychological components, is fatigue. Fatigue is associated with excessive physiological strain on the body or one of its components. Fatigue can be divided into two basic categories from a physiological perspective, which can be called exercise-related fatigue and rest-related fatigue. For example, an employee that spends most of his working hours loading trucks will most likely experience exercise-related fatigue. This fatigue is obviously relieved by a period of rest. The other type of fatigue is more or less the opposite of the above. Rest-related fatigue results from not moving the limbs. We often experience this type of fatigue when we awaken in the morning. If our job requires spending hours at a desk, with little opportunity to move or walk, we will experience rest-related fatigue. This type of fatigue can be relieved with appropriate physical exercise, which can be quite mild, such as walking a few blocks. Rest-related fatigue can be reduced or eliminated during working hours by providing some activities that involve physical movement of the limbs. For example, an individual that works at a desk can learn to move his legs and arms and stretch occasionally while he is working at his desk. Periodic breaks that involve walking and stretching can also help prevent rest-related fatigue. Requiring people that work at a desk to perform some activities that involve movement, such as running errands, cleaning the office, management by walking around, can increase their overall health and work efficiency. 3. The psychological components that relate to a job. There are many psychological components that can relate to a specific job. However, the unique psychological makeup of the individual employee, as it relates to a specific job, is of primary importance. That is, the way an individual responds to a specific job situation is very much determined by his unique psychological makeup. For example, one individual might be happy working in sanitation, because it pays good money, provides good benefits, and it provides good exercise. Another individual might consider such a job extremely distasteful, because it is associated with low social status, it is dirty, it can be somewhat dangerous, it can be physically demanding. In general, the way an individual feels about a task is an important component to consider. Another important idea is the way the individual behaves and responds in relation to a specific job situation. For example, some people become extremely nervous when faced with confusing and complicated tasks. Other individuals might find such tasks challenging in a pleasant sense. Thus, a primary consideration when choosing an employee is the psychological makeup of the employee in relation to the job-related tasks. This should not be confused with the overall psychological makeup of the employee, because many psychological components, as assessed with conventional psychological methods, can be irrelevant to a specific job. In general, the psychological data for a specific employee and job can be obtained by observation and asking the right questions. Asking an individual what he likes to do, what he does not mind doing, and what he dislikes doing, can provide useful information. For the sociological components that relate to a job, the sociological components involve the people that the employee interacts with, his culture, his subculture, his social class, and the society he lives in. An example of how a sociological component can affect an employee's behavior on the job can be seen in the Hawthorne studies, where the workers had restricted production norms. If an individual produced more than his co-workers considered appropriate, he would be verbally, and even physically, punished. This is discussed in detail in Chapter 12. Another example of a sociological component is seen in job expectations of people from different social classes. People from a working class background might believe a skilled or semi-skilled job that pays a regular salary is a satisfactory vocational achievement. People from an educated social class might believe that it is essential to have a college degree and a relatively high status occupation, which involves intellectual or mental effort. The attitudes held by an individual's social class will most likely have some influence on the way he responds to job-related tasks. The following questions can help solve problems that are related to employees and their job, with a multidisciplinary scientific management approach. What are the physical components of the job? Can the physical movements related to the job be reduced? Can the job be simplified without creating any undesirable consequences? What are the physiological stresses involved with the job? Can these stresses be reduced or eliminated? How can the physiological stresses be eliminated? What are the physiological components involved with the employee? Does the employee have the physical capability to perform the job in an efficient and effective manner? Does the employee have any physiological problems that interfere with his work? If so, how can these physiological problems be circumvented as far as the job is concerned? What are the psychological components involved with the job? How are these components affected by the physiological components? How are the physiological components affected by the psychological components? What are all the sociological components that relate to the job? Is the job a high-status job, or is it a low-status occupation? Is there any way of increasing the status of the job in such a way as to increase satisfaction? Are there any sociological components, such as a subculture or co-workers, that interfere with maximum productivity? If so, how can this problem be solved? References. Allen, Alexander, Jr. 1980 To Be Human, An Introduction to Anthropology. Newbery Award Records, Incorporated. New York, New York. Anriel Stephen J. 1983 The Handbook of Problem Solving. Petrocelli Books, Incorporated. New York/Princeton. Franklin Language Master Electronic Dictionary LM 5000. Hampton D., Summer C., and Weber R. 1978 Organizational Behavior and the Practice of Management 3rd ed. Scott, Forsman & Company, Glenview, Illinois. Hellriegel, D. and Slocum, Jr., J.W. 1996 Management, 7th ed. Southwestern College Publishing, Cincinnati, Ohio. Luthams F. and Hojets R. 1992 Business 2nd ed. The Dryden Press/Harcourt Brace Jovanovich College Publishers, Fort Worth, Philadelphia. Montana, P. 1991 Study Keys to Management Barron's Educational Series, Incorporated. Halpage, New York. Montana, P. and Charnod, B. 1993 Management, 2nd ed. Barron's Educational Series, Incorporated. Halpage, New York. Olson, Shirley A., Editor 1982 Group Planning and Problem Solving Methods in Engineering Management, John Wiley & Sons, New York. Pepper, Gerald, L. 1995 Communicating in Organizations A Cultural Approach, M.C. McGraw-Hill, Incorporated. Robbins, S.P. 1996 Organizational Behavior 7th ed. Simon & Schuster Company Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey. Roethlisberger, F.R.T.Z.J. and Dixon, William J. 1939 and 1967 Management and the Worker, 12th Printing Harvard University Press Cambridge, Massachusetts and London, England. Saul, Frank E. and Knight, Patrick K. 1995 Industrial/Organizational Psychology Science and Practice 2nd ed. Brooks Cull Publishing Company, Pacific Grove, California. Taylor, Shelley E. / Peplau, Leticia, Ann and Sayers, David O. 1994 Social Psychology 8th ed. Prentice Hall, Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey.